Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply. Hello and welcome to an interview with William Costello. And you are currently a PhD student studying individual differences and evolutionary psychology at the University of Texas. I take it you're probably in Texas right now, aren't you?
That's right, yeah, it's bright and early here. Ready to go.
Well, thank you very much for waking up to talk to us. How are you finding it in Texas?
I love it. I mean, it's hot. But I'm tending to not complain about the heat because having spent 11 years in England and having grown up in Ireland, you don't feel entitled to complain about any time the sun is shining. So
you certainly can't complain about the rain over there, can you?
Not yet. A few storms, but nothing too bad.
So you're a member of Dr. David Buss's evolutionary psychology lab as well, which is no small thing. I'm familiar with his work. I've cited him a few times in my own work, actually. And he's, to you at home, he's also known for lots of prominent books that have done very well. So that's something very exciting. And I believe your master's dissertation investigated the underlying psychology of incels, and it was awarded the best oral presentation at the British Society for the Psychology of Individual Differences Conference of 2022. So, well done.
Thanks. I must give credit to my mentor and co-author because she actually presented our findings at that conference. So it would be remiss of me not to mention my colleague, Vanya Rolan. Here at that point. So thanks, Vanya.
And you've also consulted the Commission for Countering Extremism on several occasions, and I imagine that ties into your work on incels.
Yeah, certainly. They've brought me along to give perspective on the incel topic from that point of view.
Mm-hmm. And you've also got an honorary research position at Swansea University, and you've got a series of ongoing research projects, and you have written for Quillette, Ario, I'm not familiar with them, and SciPost as well. So quite the portfolio there. Very impressive.
Yeah, keeping busy.
So starting with one of the pieces of research that is set to be published this year, which is the one that you've been doing the interview rounds for, which is the research that you've collaborated on looking at incels. And one thing that I've always struggled with is How do you best describe them? Are they a subculture? Are they an ideological movement? What's the consensus here in the academic world?
Yeah, so that's a really good question because you really have to differentiate between whether you're talking about someone who is incel, involuntarily celibate, just by circumstance, or someone who really identifies with this aspect of their own identity or personality or psychology.
Yeah. From what I've culture.
Yeah.
From what I've read, there's often a differentiation between those who self-identify and those who just meet the criteria. And I think that that's a very important distinction to make, and the literature is right to do so. certainly.
Yeah, so I always make the point that there's a big difference between a dry spell and being an infel, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we don't all, when we go through maybe a typical kind of dry spell of romantic options, you don't come to identify with this aspect of your personality. So for my dissertation research, I did use self-identification and managed to recruit 151 individuals who self-identified as incel. I was worried I wouldn't get that many participants, so I actually developed the early parts of a level of inceldom scale that would maybe quantify people who had incel typical beliefs. And I ultimately didn't have to use that because I got what I thought was enough self-identified.
It seems like a good sample incels to me, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the highest samples in incel research. It could be higher. You know, there are other bigger samples, but the other bigger samples out there tend to be from just one specific forum, whereas my sample was incels who did use forums and didn't use forums. So it's a little bit of a broader sample, even if not as many.
Mm-hmm. So would you describe them as a subculture or an ideological movement, or does it depend on the individuals in question, do you reckon?
I think it's fair to describe as a subculture or a community to some extent, to kind of differentiate that. But I mainly describe incel as kind of like that psychological condition without wanting to pathologize the kind of identity of inceldom. But if it causes you enough pain to engage with the mating market or to try and form sexual or romantic relationships, that you come to identify with that aspect more than just saying, oh, I'm having a little bit of a dry spell, that's what I would classify as incel. But you could describe them as the community, the online world. In terms of ideological movement to me describes kind of a broad agreement of causes of and solutions to a problem, whereas the beliefs in the incelosphere are quite disparate. They very rarely agree on much.
That brings me quite nicely to my next question, actually. As with all groups, there is a lots of variances within them. Would you be able to tell me a little bit about sort of lay of the land within these incel groups?
Yeah, certainly. So one thing we investigated was kind of their demographic information, political affiliation, and things like that. And one thing I would say that incels do agree on, for the most part, seems to be that they believe in something called the black pill philosophy, which is the black pill, for any listeners who aren't familiar. It's a derivative of the red pill from The Matrix,
of course,
which describes a kind of a willingness to see the world as it really is, as opposed to the blissful ignorance of the blue pill. So the black pill for incels would describe a particularly bleak truth to swallow, that there, in this case, that there is nothing that incels ever could have done to improve their romantic prospects, and it was over from the beginning, and there was no point in even trying. So in terms of like their demographics and beliefs or political affiliations, incels are often described in the media and in certain academic literature as being far right or white supremacist adjacent. So it was actually surprising to us that in our sample, we found that 36% of our sample, which was a majority UK and US sample, were actually incels of color. So that's more than you would expect by chance for the overall sample of incels and non-incels and for a UK-US sample. In terms of political affiliation, we did just ask one question, a self-identified political affiliation question. So I do recommend that for future researchers dig a little bit deeper into the political beliefs. But we found that 39% of incels reported to be right-leaning, 45% reported to be left-leaning, and 17% were centrist. So that's kind of was a little bit surprising to us based on what you'd kind of hear in the mainstream media about incels. And some other research has looked at analyzing the language in online forums, and they've found that just 3% of incel posts could be considered racist, while 30% of incel threads were considered misogynistic. And, you know, in analyses of the kind of toxic language that's seen in the forums, and there is derogatory, racialized language on there for sure, but it's not of the same character as white supremacist forums. Mm. And actually, self-hatred is the most, by far the most common form of toxic language in incel communities. It would be on one level very surprising to me that incels would be very far right or white supremacist, because a big talking point among incels is how they feel that the dating market is a little bit racist. And they kind of describe this hierarchy of races in terms of attraction to women. So that seems a pretty strange thing for white supremacists to be concerned about if they were. I don't think they'd be highlighting that.
Of course, so, yeah.
Yeah.
So I noticed that they use this language or things like red pill, black pill, and this is something that actually originated in online communities, as I understand it, because this is terminology that I understood long before I looked into incel culture and things like that, as just meaning your perspective on, say, politics. It's used in that area. If someone's red pilled, they're, you know, right wing, they're blue pilled, they're left wing, and black pilled just means nihilistic or depressed. And these are terms that have seemingly gained a different emphasis, but it also betrays some sort of origin of the nature of the people who use them, because if they've got this kind of language, it indicates that they picked it up from online internet culture, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's certainly like a bleeding of incel community culture into just very radically online culture. Mm-hmm. You know, there was one inceldom scale I saw in another study that tried to maybe use how much do you recognize these terms, and as kind of one of the questions to identify how much of an incel you were. And I kind of thought, whoa, I recognize all these terms. Maybe I'd qualify as an incel based on this. So there is a kind of a blending of the worlds. Mm-hmm. And even like black pill, people now, non-incels online, describe themselves as being black-pilled mm-hmm. on all sorts of things to believe in it or to come to know a particularly bleak truth. And there is a bit of a interesting finding, one paper called The Evolution of the Incelosphere. It describes a kind of pickup artist to incel pipeline. That incels maybe became incels because they originally tried pickup artist workshops. And mm-hmm. I actually was talking to an incel for a qualitative interview yesterday, and he described paying a lot of money to travel to Europe for, a workshop based on pickup artist and finding it miserable, and then identifying as an incel on the back of that. So it's like these tactics didn't work, trying to gamify mm-hmm. the system didn't work, so I must be therefore an incel.
I have actually worked on a video that was received a mixed reception, talking about the manosphere and how it seems to be somewhat incel adjacent almost. How does that group integrate with the incel community? Because I've been very critical about the manosphere. I think a lot of the advice that they give, it has a character of being very calculated and disingenuous. And I know some of the stated aims seem to be that, you embody this and it becomes second nature and then it becomes part of you. But then what I was pushing back on is just focus on developing yourself rather than having to game the system and learn all of these rules and project false confidence. And that was one of my main points of contention with it.
It's unfortunate because I believe like there is a vacuum there for a kind of a men's rights movement, mm-hmm. but it becomes kind of a dirty word, and it's weird. I read a really good quote from Richard Reeves, who's written a book of boys and men, all about kind of issues that boys mm-hmm. and men are facing these days. And he wrote on Twitter the other day, "Progressive left in the US has failed men by, among other things, presuming that arguing for the rights of men and boys would automatically mean rolling back women's rights or denying the existence of misogyny." And I think that's kind of right, that whenever you seem to get behind a men's cause or a men and boys issues, it's seen as inherently misogynistic. But I think I do agree with you that the Manosphere, which is a pretty broad church, you know.
Of course, yeah. I'm generalizing here. I'm probably being uncharitable to some of the people that fall under that umbrella term.
No, I don't think you are. I think it does tend to descend into toxicity, I think. But that's what happens when you drive any community or culture underground. And you don't have a real quality mainstream conversation about these issues. The people who will pick up that conversation might not be the most savory people. And, you know, when they go maybe unchecked in their communities and kind of, you know, I always say with any, bring the monster into the light. And that's when you can engage with it properly. I do think there is a vacuum for maybe an ethical pickup artistry. And my friend here in Austin, Chris Williamson, who has the Modern Wisdom podcast.
We've had him in a few times.
He has a great idea, a new kind of idea I'd really like to kind of get behind, about like a third wave of red pill. So it's kind of, and what that would describe is a willingness to see romantic issues and mating market dynamics from the perspective of the other sex, which is something that I think both sexes have been kind of reluctant to do. I think we both are committing a lot of failures of cross-sex mind reading and not willing to kind of take into account how the other sex sees things. And that kind of third wave of red pill maybe describes a willingness to move towards the middle and see men and women as allies rather than just, you know, players in a game to be manipulated. But it's funny because, you know, this you mentioned self-development, which I very much agree that should be the goal of every human, every man. Whenever you do that with the explicit goal of achieving romantic success attached to it, it gets framed as misogynistic, which is very jarring for men, because that intuitive sense of self-development in order to get the girl, you know, get the goal, get the girl, seems very intuitive to men.
It certainly does, particularly when you're younger. I've noticed specifically in myself that when I was, say, a teenager, a lot of my self-development was more focused on impressing people rather than it was for its own sake and understanding the benefits of it. And I think it's only when you get a bit older that you see that there's actually a far more all-encompassing philosophy behind it that's much much bigger than that.
Perhaps, yeah, but even if there wasn't, you know, sexual selection is a fundamental goal.
Of course, yeah.
Finding and retaining a mate is one of the ultimate evolutionary problems, so stripping kind of self-development away from that goal, I think, is a bit remiss. But it's funny, I always tell the story of Barack Obama a couple of years ago. He got in a little bit of trouble in the media because in his autobiography, he wrote that he, in his college years, he was reading certain types of literature to impress certain types of women. He was reading the Marxist literature to impress this girl in this class. And he got lambasted in the media. And to me, it seems like so intuitive that you would, that's the kind of a thing that men do.
I was going to say, when you're looking at things through an evolutionary lens, reproduction is the be-all and end-all of all organisms, isn't it? It's the most important factor. And the only reason that even survival is important is because it increases your reproductive chances. And thus, when you're looking at it through that lens, all of a sudden it seems a lot more obvious, and you see the virtues of what's being done there far more clearly than you might otherwise.
Yeah, and it's actually a beautiful kind of way to frame it, that the mind of one sex actually shapes the body and behavior of the other sex. So men tend to do whatever women will reward, and women typically reward high socioeconomic status. So men will maniacally strive for that. You know, and that's kind of a cyclical relationship. I always joke to my female friends, if you want different behavior, you need to start rewarding different things, and men will start doing it. And, you know, Jordan Peterson got in trouble for this. Recently, he was described as the incel king. Are you familiar with this?
I actually covered that on our podcast, and yeah, it was ridiculous, wasn't it?
Really just strange, because there's clips of Jordan Peterson directly talking to incels, saying that if all the women in the world don't want you, they're right. And, you know, their sexual selection
is the metric. I cited that exact same quote when I was talking about it, actually. And, he's kind of an antidote to inceldom in a way, because he's saying that people should improve themselves rather than blaming society, which is antithetical to what seems to be the incel's main unifying belief.
Absolutely, yeah. He lays the responsibility at your own door. You know, if people mm-hmm. don't want you, that even if there are societal reasons why it's become harder for men to gain romantic options or a romantic partner, that doesn't matter to the individual. All you have is, you can only play the cards you're dealt, and there's no point in saying, well, the game was a lot easier for men 50 years ago. What's the point in complaining about that? You're in this game right now. Mm-hmm. So the only option you can do is develop yourself. And that's classic JBP 101. You know, so it was very strange for me to see mm-hmm. Him being held up as incel king.
I know. You mentioned there that times have changed, and I think that there is some truth to the nature of dating certainly changing over time. And I have heard you in previous interviews talk about this, and you have some great insights on this, I think.
Yeah, and it just might be an unfortunate, uncomfortable truth to kind of reckon with, that for the first time in a number of decades, women are kind of, their socioeconomic success means that they're not having to settle for a man based on economic necessity or strict monogamy norms. Both of those things have kind of been eroded. So it means that women no longer have to settle. So they'd rather stay single. So it creates, like, women are beginning to outpace men in education and up until the age of 30 in the workplace. And it creates a culturally skewed sex ratio of highly educated and selective women to economically unattractive men. And what happens when you have a small minority of men that women are interested in, it means that that minority of men, they're reluctant to commit to long term, because you have an economics background. You know that scarcity means you can kind of create the power. You have mm-hmm. the decision making power in that ratio.
Supply and demand, isn't it? Yeah,
absolutely. And, you know, our mating strategies are very, very sensitive to sex ratios. Women will turn more promiscuous in sex ratios where they're in the majority, when there's more women, more mating competition for women. And men will be more long-term mating oriented when they're in the majority and they have more more mating market competition. And there's actually an interesting finding directly for incels. Researchers called Rob Brooks and Candace Blake were able to geographically locate areas of high online incel activity based on three variables: high levels of overall income inequality, low gender pay gaps, and male biased sex ratios, so fewer single women. So it shows that incels are kind of like partially accurate about the socioeconomic factors driving their plight, and that, you know, mating market dynamics are very sensitive to the local mating ecology, the environment it finds itself in. So mate preferences and mating strategies mm-hmm. are not just on or off. They're sensitive to the situation they find themselves.
So those factors you described there, that immediately springs to mind China. And of course, this is in the fallout of China's one-child policy. And there are obviously significantly more men than women. What problems might they expect in the future from this?
Yeah, so in the evolutionary psychology literature, we call this young male syndrome. And it basically describes that whenever you have a surplus population of unpartnered young men, they cause a lot of trouble, right? Because nothing makes a man cause less trouble than having a partner. When you have a surplus population of unpartnered young men, they have elevated status striving mechanisms, risk taking, and they cause all sorts of problems. And throughout history, whenever this has happened, there's actually been outlets to deal with this. So you might send your surplus males to the monastery, or you mm-hmm. might send them to war, as Vikings might be an example of maybe incels in the past. So there's a writer called Mary Harrington. She wrote an article about how incels could become the new Vikings to describing this phenomenon. We tend to think of Vikings as these quite sexy Netflix-style heroes. Well, but my girlfriend does anyway. That's probably not accurate. They were probably your surplus leftover. They were more like incels than the sexiest men in your community.
So I come from Plymouth in the southwest of England, where there was recently a shooting which was perpetrated by a 22-year-old man called Jake Davison. He shot and killed 5 people, and I think he injured 2 others before killing himself. So he self-described as an incel and was very nihilistic about the state of his future. What is the difference at the sort of ideological level between someone like him and your sort of garden variety incel that you might find on an internet forum? Because there's clearly going to be one.
Yeah, so this was the first alleged incel attack in the UK, and it was the worst instance of gun violence in over a decade. And it was splashed all over the media. Even Jake Davison's YouTube account videos were being played online, which seems to me irresponsible.
Like, I was just about to say exactly the same thing, yeah.
Yeah, and there's even like guidelines from the Institute for Research on Male Supremacism. They have a page on their website for recommendations for media reporting on incels. And although I think it's a bit strange to categorize incels as male supremacists when their whole identity tends to be around emphasizing their inadequacy, that seems a little bit strange to me. But I do think that the guidelines they published were pretty fair, pretty even-handed. And one of them was that we should incorporate a no-notoriety protocol whenever any spree killing or mass violence, incel violence happens. But the interesting thing about Jake Davison, aside from the media sensationalizing, is that we leapt to really categorize him as he is definitely prototypical incel. But what's less often reported is the opinion of the Deputy Senior National Coordinator for UK Counterterrorism Policing. He concluded that Jake Davison was not motivated by the misogynistic incel online movement. The shooting was not terror-related, and the incel ideology is not a terrorist movement in any case. So you very rarely, I mean, that's in one newspaper article I found on that, and, you know, it doesn't get the attention of Jake Davison, incel killer. And Jake Davison's relationship with the incel community, I mean, he certainly did use a lot of incel terminology in YouTube videos, but he had a bit more of a complex relationship to the incel world. And it often his participation in forums was trying to get people out of it, weirdly. It was like railing against the black pill. And Nama Cates, she runs a podcast called The Incel Podcast, where she talks to incels or researchers or various people who have opinions on this topic. And she wrote a really good article about this media sensationalism of incels on the back of the Jake Davison case. So I'd encourage people to check that out in the publication Unheard. But yeah, it's basically kind of this rush to sensationalize. And even if we look at this more broadly, the overall death toll that we can directly attribute to incels is around about 60. 10 of those alone can be accounted for by a guy called Alec Manazian, who was recently sentenced to 25 years to life in Toronto. He's the guy who in 2014 killed 10 people by driving his van into the crowd of people. So he accounts for 10 of the 60, just one guy. And Alec Manazian, before he did what he did, put up this Facebook post talking about how he was going to spark an incel rebellion and how we're going to overthrow the Chads and the Stacys and all hail Supreme Gentleman Elliot Rodger. Really sensationalized stuff that the media really grasped hold of. But what's less often reported is the judge's verdict in the Alec Manazian case. So I'll read directly from that to you. The judge said he told lies deliberately to depict the killings as being connected to the incel movement and get more media attention. He piggybacked on the incel movement to ratchet up his own notoriety. His story to the police about the attack being a part of an incel rebellion was a lie. So you very rarely see that reported in the media. It's kind of like hidden in the back pages, maybe, or not at all. So you know, that kind of gives a bit more perspective to the sensationalizing of the whole incel issue.
Absolutely. And we at Lotus Eaters will never pass up an opportunity to rail against the mainstream media sensationalizing about stuff. We're pretty big on that sort of stuff. But it's really interesting, the stuff you said about the Plymouth shooter, because I had no idea that actually he was perhaps on the more moderate end, trying to get people out of it.
I don't think it's fair to say he was definitively moderate.
Okay,
I think he was and this is maybe typical, I think, of incels' relationship to forums and their incel identity. Anyway, it's kind of almost like they relapse back and forth into it. It's almost like alcoholism. So I often, in my qualitative interviews with incels, I often ask, how would you know you're no longer an incel and could you become one again? And they often say, yeah, you could. And it's like, oh, okay, so you can go in and out of it. So it seems more like he seemed to just have a bit more of a complex relationship towards it.
Just me characterizing it poorly. So I understand that the research that you've worked on has found that many incels disproportionately suffer from things like anxiety and depression when compared to the rest of the population. What were you able to find out about this and perhaps many of the potential causes, despite, of course, the obvious thing of the fact they're incels in the first place?
Yeah, so it maybe comes as no surprise to people that incels have really low levels of well-being. Previous research from their in-house surveys have found that 82% of incels have strongly considered suicide. And there's lots of literature out there that shows that poor mating performance results in poor mental health, and your self-perceived mate value is a direct proxy for self-esteem. So incels scored very low in self-perceived mate value compared to non-incels in our study. But they also, we measured depression and anxiety and loneliness and life satisfaction. So to measure depression, we used the instrument used by the NHS in the UK, which is the PHQ-9. And to put their levels of depression into context for you, using that diagnostic instrument that's used by the NHS, 73% of incels in our sample could be clinically diagnosed as severely or moderately severely depressed. That's compared to 33% of non-incels in our sample, which I thought was pretty high anyway.
That's a massive number, yeah.
Right. So in terms of anxiety, again, we used the GAD-7, which is the instrument used by the NHS to measure anxiety. And 67% of incels could be clinically diagnosed as severely or moderately anxious, compared to 38% of non-incels. Their levels of loneliness was significantly higher than non-incels, and that was our biggest effect size in our findings, so very lonely. And that kind of dovetails in with some other research by a guy called Brandon Sparks, who found that incels just lack social support more generally and lack friends, not just romantic prospects. So, you know, you could be dealing with just a broader loneliness issue.
That seems somewhat unsurprising, really, because one of the main ways that most people meet a romantic partner is that it's through social circles. Obviously, there are things like online dating apps as well, which have certainly changed the face of dating. But from my understanding, at least, just anecdotally, most people who are in successful long-term relationships met through their social circles. So having that cut off from them would clearly be a massive disadvantage to them.
Oh, yeah, I think so. And even beyond that, if you are to struggle romantically, having that friendship network to buffer against those low well-being feelings would be huge. You know, you tend to you see some articles coming out in Psychology Today or different places that talk about how singlehood is on the rise, but it's not so bad. That's fine. You know, some people love being single. And those people tend to be quite popular people who maybe wouldn't struggle to find a partner anyway and have really rich friendship groups to kind of buffer against this singlehood. They don't tend to be describing incels there. So I think that could be an outlet to help incels. But these kind of, maybe there's a lack of social outlets for men more generally now. And men's friendships tend to be group oriented rather than dyadic, whereas female friendships are very one-to-one, and women generally invest more in their broader goals evolutionarily than men. Men tend to strive for status very singularly and neglect friendships in their life and family relationships and things like that. Women tend to spread themselves more evenly and perhaps create a more rounded life. And that's something that Richard Reeves, I think, talks about in this new book of Boys and Men, that he encourages men to kind of spread themselves a bit more broadly around a number of different status domains rather than just one.
That makes perfect sense to me. So something that I mentioned earlier is the online dating sphere, and kind of shifting more to the evolutionary psychology side of things, there are lots of interesting aspects of society and this sort of, where the sort of sexual selection and sexual attraction side of things, and of course the fact that you can collect data from these apps as well. And one thing that I've seen is that it's sort of vindicated the Pareto principle, or the 80-20 rule of the top 20% and are desired by the 80% or what have you. And this is often applied to female attraction towards men. And this is something that incels often talk about, or at least from what I understand. And it's something that actually I find it difficult to disprove, even though it seems at a very base level to not necessarily be true.
Yeah, I think the 80-20 is a little bit of a crude analysis, but it does speak to a general kind of phenomenon. Attraction inequality is kind of real. More men are attracted to more women than vice versa. I kind of describe it like sex and romance for men is kind of like pizza. There's good pizza and there's pizza. There's no bad pizza. Whereas for women, that's not the case. So there is really bad pizza for women. But yeah, one data point to point you towards there is my former supervisor at Swansea, Dr. Andrew Thomas, he recently had a paper that used data from 1.8 million online daters from 24 countries. And one of the first findings in his analysis was this massive attraction inequality, whereby some, particularly among males, some users were getting lots of matches, lots of winks, lots of swipes, and lots of messages, and some were getting none at all. So it was a very, very unequal kind of distribution. He also found in that research that resource acquisition ability or competency, so your level of education and income, increased levels of romantic interest for men at 2.5 times the rate of women. And this sex difference was found in every one of the 24 countries that they analyzed. So I recently wrote an article for Barry Weiss's 10-year anniversary of Tinder. She had a symposium of different writers giving perspectives on it. And I talked about how dating apps are an extremely evolutionarily novel and kind of ubiquitous feature of the modern mating market. And they kind of give you a very impoverished sense of cues with which to make your mating decisions. For most of our evolutionary history, you would make decisions based on maybe a couple of dozen potential mates that you might meet in your lifetime. Tinder or dating apps allow you to meet more in one afternoon than you would in an entire lifetime for most of our ancestral environment. And it also strips away those cues of scent, kind of the dynamism of personality and interactivity. I always use the example that it doesn't allow you to use a nice Irish accent to compensate for being quite short in height, which I've been dining out on for my entire romantic career. But yeah, like even if you use height as an example, for no personal reason to me at all, there was the relationship science, the data analysis of Hinge, Logan Urey, she talked about how if women in America set their dating parameters to 6 foot as the limit for a man that they want to attract, that they limit their dating pool to something like just less than, I think it was like 13% of America. And if they go 6'3" and over, it's down to just 3%. Which is just, you know, a crazy shrinking of your dating pool in one fell swoop. So I think the dating apps do kind of, the fact that they're so evolutionary novel and distant from the way we have made our mating decisions in the past, maybe exacerbate this attraction inequality a little bit, because mm-hmm. it kind of emphasizes this information like, what's your job, what's your education, what's your height, compared to a more dynamic, holistic, overall picture in real life.
Yeah, and I know that height in particular for men is a very important thing. Sorry to bring that point up. But yeah, I think that that's one of those things that is very static, and I think that that's one thing that you can't really change, but can certainly be mitigated against.
Yeah, no amount of Cuban heels seem to do the trick. But I usually make the point that for the most part, women's mate preferences in men are more malleable. Men can actually change their status in the hierarchy. You can always accrue more status. You can earn more money. You can get a better job. You can do all these things, except for height. You can't really do much about the height. And there was a recent article in, I think, GQ or Men's Health, one men's magazine, that kind of talked about this recent trend for men to undergo surgery, cosmetic surgery, where they break their legs in order to gain like 4 or 5 inches of height. And it's like, whoa, you know, the lengths people are going to. But I suppose women have been going under the knife for cosmetic surgery for a long time. But it feels a bit more harrowing when you think about it as someone willing to break their legs to add on a bit more height, and it seems a bit extreme.
Yeah, it does. It's kind of horrifying, really. I would hate to have my legs willingly broken, but then I'm talking as someone who's over 6 foot, so maybe I'd feel a bit differently.
Chads like you don't need to worry about it.
Thank you. So on the topic of the dating apps, one thing that's come to mind is that the data might potentially reflect, or at least this is just an idea that I've had, the kinds of people that are drawn to dating apps, because of course it's not necessarily a perfectly objective sample of the population. There are going to be clear factors that draw people to using apps like that. One thing, I've dipped my toe into it briefly and realized it's probably not for me, when I realized that it was mostly judged on pictures and hardly anyone had actually written a bio about who they actually are as a person. And I thought, well, surely that latter part is at least a significant part of it, yet people have neglected to even bother writing out something in a couple of minutes. And that was the majority of people, at least when I had a nosy at it. And I think that seems to suggest to me that there's perhaps a more superficial crowd, maybe, not to be too general about it, than the wider population, and that might lead the data not to reflect the population as a whole.
Yeah, so I did see that study that online daters have a greater proclivity to dark triad traits. The dark triad describes psychopathy, narcissism, and Machiavellianism. It's kind of a cluster of personality traits that's considered quite manipulative and dark. But I find that finding a little bit strange when we consider everyone is on dating apps, pretty much. I know there's a recent kind of pushback against them and, you know, other sorts of alternatives. I was taking the tube in London before I came to America, and I saw posters about, you know, companies that would rent out a bar just for singles, and the whole mantra was get off the apps, meet in real life. And kind of there is this little pushback. People do seem to have a general malaise, a kind of dissatisfaction with them. I tend to agree with you. Yeah, my own brief experiences that I ever had using dating apps personally, often you would find that people would message you and it would become obvious that they hadn't read your profile at all. And I imagine that's twice as bad for women.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I would say it's just, you know, the sheer volume of profiles and matches that people get on there by just swiping, and then going to maybe message. It just gives you this FOMO, fear of missing out, and you're perhaps less willing to spend the time engaging, getting to know someone, because you think there's someone else out there. You get this impression that there's an unlimited amount of mates, which again is a massively evolutionary novel idea. But they're a ubiquitous feature of the modern mating market. They're, you know, everyone is busy. You know, I used the point of my former colleague. She was quite unhappily single for a long time. And she used to talk to me about asking for advice, or how is she going to find romantic partner. And I said, you've got to get on the apps. And she said, oh, I don't want to use the apps. I said, well, you leave the office at 6 p.m. You take the train home Monday to Friday. You have the weekend to go out, maybe. When are you going to meet someone on the train? You know, it's like, if you're not using the apps, what are you hoping that someone will just approach you on the train home from work and that will work? You know, it's kind of, it maybe is a bit bleak, but it is the dating arena now. Mm. And, you know, that's even brought forward by facts. Like, I think upwards of 40% of couples in the US now report to have met online. But I suppose we need to make the point that initial matching online, meeting online, you still meet in real life, but it's just that initial brokerage happens in the online world. But yeah, there is a bit of a dissatisfaction culturally, I think, towards them, and maybe there needs to be a change. I mean, you see all sorts of kind of modern pushback against this, people making their own dating app kind of applications. Like, they make their own website now. I've seen this as a new trend on Twitter, where it's very more personalized. They can ask whatever questions they want specifically. So that's an interesting new trend. So yeah, it's but that's, it is the modern mating market. I wouldn't advise people, oh, just give up on the apps, because, you know, that's, it's where a lot of people are, but maybe use them a bit more intentionally, something like that.
No, that seems like good advice, because my intuition after my experiences is to say that they're sort of net negative, that sure, there can be some benefits, but I see it as a push towards superficiality, and I have to stop myself and say, actually, no. Although it is a massive convenience, it's still bringing people together ultimately, and how it's a tool like any other, and how you use it is up to you. And yeah. I've had to stop myself being full of contempt for what I saw as technology kind of seeping into what used to be an interpersonal thing. But I think that's just me existing before the internet age.
And I think we have a tendency to maybe look at dating in the wild as a bit more with rose-tinted glasses. You know, it's no picnic to approach women out in a club or a bar and get rejected in real life. That seems to me a bit more viscerally painful than someone ghosting you or not responding. And particularly for like socially anxious incels, you know, telling them, get off the apps, get out there and run game in the daytime at a local coffee shop. It's like, ooh, I don't know. And is that any picnic for women either, being approached constantly out in the wild? I know they tend to complain and say, no one approaches in real life anymore. And they have this maybe idea of a meet cute from a Hollywood movie. That just doesn't really, I don't see that happening that often. I think it takes a high level of kind of social skills and a very winning personality to pull something like that off. And, you know, in the Me Too kind of post Me Too era, you might be setting yourself up for being labeled a creep if you make an approach. For example, you know, approaching someone in your university or in your workplace is very frowned upon now, whereas that was traditionally a place where a lot of people would meet. And, you know, we all spend our time at work a lot. So it's like, both my brothers met their partners at work, so I don't want to get them cancelled now. But, you know, it's strange to kind of just, we're limiting people's opportunities to actually cultivate romantic prospects, I think.
When my friends have come to me and asked for advice on this sort of thing, I've always given them the advice that it's always better not to force something, to go out there and just see what happens sort of organically. And I've always been kind of scorned the cold approach as being a little bit, as what you say, a little bit sex pesty. That's a really uncharitable way of putting it, but you know what I'm getting at.
That I think you're right.
You're hassling people when they might not want the hassle. They could have had a terrible day. Maybe they don't want to talk to anyone. And I think that a lot of people can smell the desperation from a mile away as soon as someone says hello. That was my understanding.
And I think women, they have a very sensitive sensitivity to something called the ick. They can smell it a mile away when you're going in with one intention. You have to kind of come in under the radar and almost make them think it was their idea. You know, you can't let them know for sure that you're trying with them. That I think that's repellent for whatever reason, which is unfortunate. Because, you know, maybe less ambiguity in romantic communication between the sexes would be very important, because this is an interesting finding. So my lecturer at Brunel in London, she had some data to show that a lot of women misrepresent romantic interest, particularly in real life, out of fear of what the man might say back if she rejects him outright, or she might just not want to hurt his feelings or want to be kind, or, you know, for whatever reason, or even just enjoy being flirty, but not actually have the romantic interest. This works terribly for men, because men have what's called a sexual overperception bias. And evolutionarily, it makes sense. It was a worse strategy for men to miss the signal. It was better to perceive sexual interest when there was none and be wrong 99 times out of 100 in order to be right that one time out of 100. Mm-hmm. So men have this overperception bias whereby any woman that smiles at us, we think, oh, I'm in there. Whereas women might be smiling out of a million different reasons, one of which could be fear of what you might get angry if you're rejected more outright. But it leads to like a massive kind of cross-sex failure of mind reading, whereby we're totally misperceiving each other. So
I know,
a bit
exactly.
Less ambiguity from everyone would probably be better.
Mm-hmm. I certainly know in my younger years, if I were complimented, which is a rare thing for a man to get in the first place, I'd think, wow, she must be interested in me. But now I'm older and much more experienced, it seems absurd to me that I even thought that in the first place. But you can certainly see how you might come to those conclusions.
Yeah, your ancestors were the guys that didn't miss any signal. So
that's true.
They weren't the ones that stood around wondering, is she smiling at me? No, they shot their shot, so to speak.
So now we're sort of on to evolutionary psychology. What is perhaps one of the most common misconceptions about things in the dating world that evolutionary psychology seems to push against, at least in your opinion?
Yeah, I think one of the maybe poorly understood findings from evolutionary psychology is around those sex differences in mate preferences. Whenever we hear about mate preferences, what's always overemphasized is the areas in which men and women differ. So men value physical attractiveness more than women, and women value ability to provide resources as more important than men do. But what's less often talked about is how similar our mate preferences are. In all the studies, the top mate preferences have always been love, intelligence, and kindness. So, you know, we tend to focus, zero in on where the differences lie rather than where the similarities are. And that was actually something we found in our study. We analyzed incels and men in general, their perception of female mate preferences. And we found that neither were very good at perceiving what women said their preferences were. You know, they tend to underestimate the importance of intelligence, kindness, humor, things like that, which do carry a lot of importance to women. So that's one idea. I also think what I mentioned earlier about the sensitivity to things like sex ratios and cultural norms. You know, you can assign status to anything if you want. I use the example in one hunter-gatherer tribe. They assign status to whichever farmer in that tribe can grow the biggest yam. And that's the most high status dude in that culture. So, you know, we can assign status to lots of things. And maybe one of the things we could assign status to in order to create a mate preference for it is something like being an involved stay-at-home dad. That might become the sexy high status thing to do. But I'm a little bit pessimistic on that, because recent studies have showed that just 5% of women desired a relationship in which they worked full-time and their partner worked part-time or not at all. So that's pretty bleak on that front. But so I'm optimistic on one level, pessimistic on another. But yeah, just how sensitive evolved mate preferences are to the environmental input. They're not just on or off. They're to some extent malleable.
Sure. So what would you be able to tell me about the evolutionary mismatch in mating?
Yeah, so we got into a little bit about this earlier. Mm-hmm. So evolutionary mismatch refers to the idea that the world around us now differs radically from the environments in response to which our psychological mechanisms evolved. So, you know, for most of our evolutionary history, for example, we would have encountered perhaps a couple of dozen potential mates in a lifetime. And as such, persistent sexual rejection would have been perceived as catastrophic. And this might actually make things worse for incels, who can rack up more rejection in one day than would be possible in a lifetime in our ancestral environments. You know, from a rational point of view, rejection shouldn't hurt so much now, because there are literally thousands of more fish in the sea. It should just be, okay, she doesn't want me, move on, go again. But rejection in our ancestral environments would have been catastrophic, because it would have led to a bad reputation. And women in particular do what's called mate copying. So if women get a kind of a cue that other women in their culture don't want you, that kind of snowballs. And it's very hard to overcome that reputation. So we're still kind of bootstrapped with these psychological mechanisms. The way we describe it is our modern skulls house a Stone Age brain. Culture has evolved way faster than our actual psychological mechanisms. So that's what evolutionary mismatch means. In terms of evolutionary mismatch in mating, you also have the fact that we're very independent in our mating choices now. We're responsible for our own mating life. That's very evolutionary novel. Most of the time it would have been your kin and your wider culture would have arranged all these things for you, which would take a kind of a FOMO away, a less responsibility, less decision-making responsibility. You also have the fact that, you know, a young woman, for most of our evolutionary history, a 20-year-old woman would have been a young mother in most hunter-gatherer societies. That's very much not the case now. People are decidedly delaying having offspring until even mid to late 30s now. You know, you have women earning their own economic... We're not reliant on each other as much as we have been. So maybe singlehood is more prioritized, because you don't need to depend on your partner. So just the fact that we find ourselves in huge cities away from our kin... So many different features. And there's a really good paper that my supervisor was a co-author on, called Evolutionary Mismatch in Mating. And I'd encourage your listeners to check that out. It's really interesting. Paints that picture better than I can here describing it.
So what can people do to mitigate this problem? Because I've kind of gone to a bit of an extreme, because I was aware of this evolutionary mismatching quite a long time ago when I was studying at university, and I ended up taking up things like bushcraft and survivalism and going out to Dartmoor National Park and living on the land in a sort of Stone Age way. But I don't necessarily recommend everyone do that. But it does illuminate quite a lot in terms of the change in your lifestyle. When you come back to civilization, as it were, you really appreciate aspects that you would have completely taken for granted beforehand. So I can understand that what I have done there is probably taking it a little bit too far, although it is good fun and I do recommend it. Is there anything a bit more reasonable that people who aren't as fanatical about it as I am could do?
So I'm not like anti-civilization. I'm very kind of pro-civilization. I think it's better than most of our ancestral environments.
I'm not saying that.
But one thing I think we could maybe lean into, rather than the paleo kind of hunting dating strategy, is to maybe use our networks. You mentioned earlier that networks are a great way to meet people romantically. Mm-hmm. So it needn't be, you know, asking your family to set you up on an arranged marriage or anything as extreme as that. But we do have a bit of a reluctance to kind of lean on our friends to ask them to set us up with someone. It's kind of, it feels a bit cringe to do that. But, you know, what a better strategy. You know, you've got you've got them and all their networks. They know you very well. They know their friends very well. And it gets past this kind of stranger danger type thing. You know, strangers for most of our evolutionary history represented a massive threat. So third party endorsement from someone you trust is huge, particularly for women. You know, if you go into a bar and you've got female friends with you, that's immediately disarming for women around. They think, oh, someone has. And even when you have a girlfriend, sometimes you get even more attention. I've noticed.
I've noticed that as well. It's weird, isn't it? Yeah. I've not been able to figure out. I suppose it's just that people want what they can't have. That's the way I've kind of tried to reconcile it a little bit,
maybe. But I think it's more like a social proofing type thing. Mm. It's like someone has vetted him and considered him valuable enough, and he's able to maintain a relationship. And actually, one of the new pieces of information I found from my female friends over here in Austin is that they use a man's relationship history, not just like body count or sexual history or anything like that, but has this man, what has his relationship history been like? Has he been able to maintain stable long-term relationships? Or is he the type of guy that says, all my exes are crazy? Like, you know, that's kind of off-putting to women.
Before, yeah.
Yeah. So I think like using your networks, mm-hmm. Which are kind of like a proxy kin now in our world, you know, we all have our chosen family type thing. We might live thousands of miles away from our real family, and we might feel reluctant to ask them to help you romantically anyway, but surely we can lean on our friends and, mm-hmm. you know, maybe use that, those kind of social worlds a little bit more intentionally.
I certainly see it as a part of being someone's friend to at least wingman them a little bit. I mean, it's part of the friendship obligation as I see it, but yes. One final question before closing up. If you were to give one piece of advice to the people listening or watching at home, what would that be and why did you choose to give it?
Not trying to get myself cancelled or anything, okay. But I personally derived a lot of benefit from following Jordan Peterson's advice. Around about 2016, 2017, I started listening to him while I was a little bit rudderless kind of in my life, feeling mm-hmm. a little bit maybe unfulfilled, kind of plateaued in my career, and felt I had a lot more intellectual kind of life in me. And his idea of just make the next day one small bit better than the previous day, and see where it takes you and take yourself seriously, that kind of really resonated in me. And as I like N of one study, since I started doing that, the trajectory of my life has skyrocketed, and I'm now in my dream opportunity. That if you told me back then that that's where I would get to, I wouldn't have even believed it was a realistic goal. But I managed to just get there by literally those small steps, not even thinking that far ahead, just thinking more, what habits can you cultivate? How can you make? So rather than having big lofty goals, think about what systems can you put in place and see where that will take you. Mm-hmm. That's a better option than thinking, you know, too far ahead at the target, in my opinion.
No, that's really good advice. And I'm also a big fan of Peterson. I mean, I was actually listening to his lectures on YouTube, I think this is in sort of 2015, 2016, when they had about 200 views as like supplementary listening to my personality lectures. And then all of a sudden he became big, and it took me a while to put two and two together. Like, oh, right, that's the same guy that I was watching on YouTube when I was studying psychology.
I really like his older videos, particularly when he goes full clinical counselor kind of mode and talks about relationship advice. And he's quite good humoured. Or well-humoured in those, compared to maybe now he's a bit intense.
I have noticed that
it's nice to see him smile and laugh and be jovial with his class. He'd be a hell of a teacher. You know, imagine being in his classroom. You'd be captivated. And you can tell, like, from watching his lectures, the students are captivated.
Well, I mean, I certainly was captivated when I was watching his material when I was actually learning psychology at university, so I can kind of attest to it, although I wasn't in the same room, but still, it's certainly a compelling thing. But anyway, thank you very much for your time, and it has been a pleasure and really interesting to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for having me on.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com.
Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at Chumbacasino.com.
Welcome to the family.